And there's a long historical relationship between Park Street and the Fuller Theological Seminary, which we may hear a word about. And then I'll be back to the microphone to introduce our speaker.
Hi, my name is Daniel Harrell. Lucy Guernsey had contacted me about saying a little bit about the connection between Park Street Church and Fuller Seminary. I got a chance to meet a couple of former Park Street folks who knew Dr. Harold John Ockingay, of course, who was one of the founders of Fuller Seminary. I spent the week going around to some of our members who were around during that time, sort of getting a sense from them what it was like to have their pastor in Boston be also president of a seminary out in Pasadena. And I think their general memory was that he traveled a lot. I think he went back and forth like 200 times over the course of the early years of Fuller's founding, which of course in the late 40s and early 50s was no small feat. And they remarked as well that given his just a workaholic habits, that he was able somehow to keep both things in balance and somehow do both things well. As we were talking around the staff a little bit about the Ockingay legacy, we thought of three things that were sort of important to us as we think of Park Street Church, but in some sense, a Fuller Seminary too. I've had a bit of experience with Fuller, getting to teach out there a couple of years ago, and some of their graduates have made their way to Park Street Church, and some of my friends serve as professors there. And as we think about Harold Ockingay and the Park Street Fuller connection, three things came to mind. One was how it seems that Ockingay insisted during this time that he was beginning this sort of neo-evangelical movement in response to American fundamentalism, that it was so important that we engage with the culture rather than separate out from it. And thus he encouraged people in his church, and we still have this legacy today, to be involved for us in the city of Boston, to be involved with the universities and with the things that are in our neighborhood, the financial district and the neighborhoods, not to just preserve or defend, I should say, the faith and sit on the corner where we sit on the Boston Common in Boston. The second thing that we remember so much from Ockingay is his insistence that rather than drawing lines, that we seek to dissolve them. Never make an enemy when you can make a friend. One of the things that the old-timers remember most at Park Street Church is Ockingay's feuding with Cardinal Cushing during the 50s, but that how nevertheless he received an invitation to speak at the Paulus Center, which is next door to us, and he took that invitation and went and spoke, and I understand was received warmly. And finally, the thing we appreciate most from Ockingay is his insistence that we never retreat as evangelicals intellectually, and thus his founding of Fuller Seminary and Gordon Conwell Christianity Today, as well as his legacy of preaching and other things, have been an encouragement to us to continue that intellectual pursuit that is such an important part of what it means to be a Christian in our world. So on behalf of Park Street Church and its long history with Fuller Seminary, we welcome you, Dr. Mao, and welcome to Boston. And if any of you are ever in the downtown area, be sure to stop into Park Street. We'd love to say hello.
For reasons that perhaps I might owe you an explanation for, which I'll give you in a minute, I'm often asked about Western Europe, and in particular, I'm asked about Holland. And one of the questions that people always ask me about Holland is, why is Holland the most secular country in the world? And the answer I always give is because all the Christians left to come to the United States and teach at Calvin College. Now, the reason why people ask me about Holland is because my wife is from Denmark, and as all Americans know, either Amsterdam is the capital of Holland, or Copenhagen is the Amsterdam is the capital of Denmark, or Copenhagen is the capital of Holland. But we get this all the time in our family, and so because I'm married to a Dane, I somehow feel a special connection to things Dutch. Rich Mao was at Calvin College for 17 years before moving in 1985 to the Fuller Theological Seminary, where he is now the president. He is one of the most important evangelical voices in the United States, if not the most important evangelical voice in the national conversation about religion that's been taking place in the United States for some time. As I'm sure most of you know, he's a philosopher with a doctorate from the University of Chicago. He's the author of a number of extremely important books, including Political Evangelism and The Smell of Sawdust, What Evangelicals Can Learn from Their Fundamentalist Heritage. He served on numerous editorial boards and other institutional affiliations. I have a long and, for me, very valued friendship with him and his wife, Phyllis, that goes back to a series of seminars that were funded by the Lilly Endowment that brought together people who write and think about religion and American public life in a number of different settings, ranging from the luxurious retreats of South Bend, Indiana, to Key Largo and other workaday places. And over the course of these seminars and over the course of the years, I had a special affinity with Rich, and I've just learned so much from him. It's been an extraordinary pleasure, as well as an intellectual experience, to have gotten to know him so well, to have gotten to know him as a person, and to have gotten to know how he thinks. Since the seminar ended a couple of years ago, we've been able to keep up this connection. He graciously hosted a group of Muslims from the Middle East and Southeast Asia that came to Boston College under the auspices of the U.S. State Department to learn about the separation of church and state in the United States last fall. And I was asked by the State Department, when they asked me to direct this program, to pick one other location and one other institution in the United States that from which they would learn the most. And I immediately called Rich and asked if Fuller would host that, and they did. And we had 8 marvelous days in Pasadena, a truly remarkable experience of bringing together a secular Jewish professor from Boston College, a Catholic institution, bringing 15 Muslims to an evangelical seminary in Pasadena, California. It seemed to me the very definition of what the United States is about. So Rich is the second of our annual lectures. This is our most important event of the year at the Boise Center, our lecture on the prophetic voice of the church. The first one last year was given by Donald Monin, the president of Catholic Charities. This year, Richard J. Mao, the president of the Fuller Theological Seminary. Father Brian Hare, the president of Catholic Charities. Please forgive me, Father Monin. It just goes to show you who my two favorite Catholic presidents are. Rich, after that faux pas, the floor is yours. Thank you so much for coming and honoring us with your presence and to address the themes of the evening.
It's an honor to be here, but it's also a delight to think of the, I have good friends at Boston College, and the chief among them is Alan Wolf. I recently offered a comment to his publisher on his forthcoming book, which is a wonderful book. I said there, Alan, I consider Alan Wolf one of my teachers, and I've learned so much from him. But even more than that, I cherish our friendship. And the connections with Boston College, be back here on this campus, and to connect with Fuller people who are in this area. Just delighted that Fuller alums have come this evening, and then also with Park Street Church. The Erdmann's Publishing Company is going to reissue a book by Carl Henry, who was one of the founding members of the faculty at Fuller Theological Seminary, a book that he published in the year of Fuller's founding, 1947. Very important book, really, for the discussion this evening, a book entitled The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism, 1947. And Harold John Ockingay wrote the foreword to that book. And in an amazing few sentences for 1947, he says, Bible-believing Christians, fundamental Christians, have typically been on the wrong side of the issues of race, militarism, and a concern for the poor. That's amazing, I think, in 1947. As a matter of integrity, I have to add that, and I'm embarrassed to say this on a Jesuit campus, but that he also felt they hadn't been strong enough in opposing the liquor industry, but that we'll just take that to be a throwaway line this evening. But I want to talk about the present state of that evangelical mind as it bears on issues of public life. What would it take for evangelicals to have an important and positive, healthy voice, a prophetic voice, in American public life? And when I say what would it take, it's going to be clear from what I say that I don't think we as yet have enough of what it takes. In case some of you need a definition of evangelicals to start with, I'll offer a very brief one. I could spend a whole series of lectures on how to define the term evangelical. It's been much debated, but it's an interesting phenomenon that a British historian, evangelical historian of the British churches, David Bebbington, who teaches at the University of Stirling, published a book in 1989 where he set out four defining characteristics of evangelicalism. And it's quite amazing that this set of criteria has sort of taken, and it's generally used as an adequate working definition or account of what it means to be an evangelical. Four characteristics. Evangelicals are people who place a very strong emphasis on personal conversion. They're conversionists, he says. That is, they place a strong emphasis on the need for repentance and having one's life transformed from our natural sinfulness to a life of obedience to God through a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Secondly, he uses the word biblicist, and he means this in a positive way. A group of people who take seriously biblical authority as the supreme guide for matters of faith and practice, not as the only source of truth, but rather as the test of truth. Wherever else we get our information from, ultimately the Bible trumps. The Bible is the supreme authority. And thirdly, he uses the word crucicentric or cross-centered. Evangelicals place a very central emphasis on the cross of Jesus Christ and the substitutionary atoning work of the cross as really the only source of salvation that is available to us. And then finally, it's an activist movement. There's a very strong emphasis on very ordinary Christians doing stuff. Typically, it's doing personal evangelism, witnessing to one's neighbors. But there are other dimensions of evangelical activism as well. The typical number that gets thrown around in American discussions of religious movements is that there are 50 million evangelicals. That's an interesting number politically, because that means that the evangelical vote is roughly similar to the Roman Catholic vote. And if somehow evangelicals and Roman Catholics were to work together, they could be a very powerful combined voice in American public life. And in fact, the similarities, the growing similarities and rapprochement between evangelicals and Roman Catholics is a very interesting phenomenon in recent years. And I'm going to be paying special attention to that this evening, not just because I'm on this campus, but it is a certainly one motive, but also because I think the growing relationship is a very important one for matters that we will be talking about this evening. Many of you know about the much-discussed book by Philip Jenkins called The Next Christendom. Phil Jenkins, who's a professor at Penn State. There was an essay version of this in the October 2002 issue of the Atlantic Monthly, in which he points out that easily the growing edge of Christianity in the world is in the Southern Hemisphere, in what we often think of as the two-thirds world. And indeed, by the year 2050, the vast majority of Christians in the world will be in Africa and Asia and Latin America, and that all the signs are that the overwhelming pattern of faith in the increasing numbers of, or among the increasing numbers of Christians in the two-thirds world, is either evangelical or Roman Catholic. And that on the evangelical side, they tend to be Pentecostal charismatic, and on the Roman Catholic side, they tend to be very traditionalist. So the phenomenon of, say, liberal Protestantism in the United States, or even the more progressive side of Roman Catholicism in the United States, in terms of world presence, just sheer numbers, is going to be an increasingly diminishing factor in the tone of global Christianity. And so as we think about how evangelicals can assume a healthier prophetic role in American religious life, and also what they can learn from and be engaged in partnership with Roman Catholics in this project, this has very important implications for global Christianity, and indeed, I think, the global culture. But before going any further, let me just say some things about my own personal interest and involvement in the discussion of evangelicals in public life. I've spent most of my life, including my academic life, within the evangelical Protestant community, and I've devoted most of my attention as a teacher and as a scholar to promoting a healthy evangelical involvement in the public square. When I began my career in the late 1960s, the evangelicals did not show much of an interest in pursuing issues of public life. With all the publicity given in recent years to the Christian right, it takes some effort to remember that there was a time not too many decades ago when evangelical Christians were regularly being criticized by the liberal establishment for being apolitical. The historian George Marsden once remarked that for American evangelicals, the move from the 19th century to the 20th century was something like an immigrant experience, with the migration being spiritual rather than geographic. As this century got started, those Christians who thought of themselves as Bible-believing Christians, loyal to the fundamentals of the faith, were in a mood where they no longer felt at home in the culture that they had once praised as America the Beautiful, with its patriot's dream of alabaster cities and the like. And for a while, they adopted a militant strategy of opposing the increasing secularization of American culture. But their public humiliation during the 1925 Scopes trial, coupled with the significant defeats that they experienced in the intra-Protestant fundamentalist modernist controversies, where they basically lost control of some of the major seminaries and most of the denominational mission boards, their defeat in those areas led them to be increasingly pessimistic about the possibilities of social reform. So for nearly five decades, American evangelicals concentrated primarily on helping individuals get ready to go to heaven. And that was the mood that prevailed when I was growing up in the evangelical world. We did not think it was appropriate for our kind of Christians to be very involved in public life. One of our favorite songs began with these lines: "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore." We saw ourselves as a faithful band of believers in a world that was headed for destruction. Our analysis of the larger culture was characterized by the kind of apocalyptic imagery that had been made popular by the 19th century evangelist Dwight L. Moody. Moody had said, "The American ship is sinking, and the only task left is to urge individuals to scramble into the lifeboats, the enclaves of Bible-believing Christians who are awaiting the heavenly rescue operation." Well, my own perspective changed significantly as a graduate student in the wild 60s. I became convinced that evangelical Christians should be actively involved in political witness. And I engaged in such activities, often with a sense of deep alienation from the evangelical community. And soon, however, I sensed the call to the evangelical segment of the academy, a position from which I was able to work for an aggressive evangelical involvement in movements of social, political, and economic reform. In my first book that was published in 1973, entitled Political Evangelism, I made a sustained case for a more activist evangelicalism. Well, the evangelical mood has changed dramatically in recent decades, as evangelicals who had spent a half century thinking of themselves as a marginalized cognitive minority suddenly emerged as a bold moral majority. That's an amazing shift, a moral majority in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Nor has this political reawakening been welcomed by the liberal folks who had gotten accustomed to taunting evangelicals for their escapist mentality. Many of those critics are probably praying passionately right now that evangelical activists will soon go back to helping individuals board the lifeboats. Well, to be honest, I've sometimes been tempted to pray for that myself. Given the ways in which evangelicals have been aggressively public in their social witness in the past few decades, there are times when I wish I were in a position to call the whole thing off, urging the evangelical community to return to its earlier posture of politically passive otherworldliness. That we would stop singing, "Shine, Jesus, shine, fill this land with the Father's glory," and go back to saying, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through." I've cultivated an appreciation for the sense of humor displayed in a comment made in 1656 by John Reeve, who was the self-styled prophet of a very interesting British sect known as the Muggletonians. Reeve ridiculed the notion that was quite popular in his day that Christ would return to establish a literal millennial kingdom over which he would reign as king. Reeve insisted that it's highly unlikely that Jesus would want to return to earth to establish such a political regime. After all, he observed, Jesus had already suffered much during the last time that he lived on earth. Why would he want to come back as a politician and suffer again? Isn't one round of intense divine misery enough? And I've been tempted to add my own spin to Reeve's line of argument in the light of recent evangelical behavior in the public arena. And even if Jesus did not suffer enough during his first earthly tour of duty, I ask myself, isn't it likely that he has by now at least had his fill of Christian politics? Hasn't at least his capacity for political suffering finally reached its limit? But in my calmer moments, I know that that there should be no turning back. And instead, we need to move forward to a more mature understanding of the issues of public life. And I think that this maturation prospect and process has to focus to a large degree on developing a new level of spiritual and theological wisdom. But there are some obstacles to this process with regard to evangelical public life. And I want to talk a bit about why it is that what these obstacles are to evangelicals becoming more theologically and spiritually mature in their approach to the issues of public life. One obstacle is just simply an imbalance in evangelicalism on a popular level, but even also among some of the elite types. In understanding the prophetic role itself. And I asked to talk tonight about an evangelical prophetic voice. We talk a lot about prophecy, but the problem is it's speculation about predicted events in the Bible. And that kind of prophecy tends to reinforce a pattern among evangelicals of a kind of passive observer approach, a sidelines approach to the issues of public life. There's an old distinction in theology that's been used to distinguish between two dimensions of the prophetic task. Prophesying includes both, and this is the old formula, foretelling and forthtelling. The biblical prophets were allowed by the illumination of God's Spirit to look into the future. They foretold events that were to come. But they also spoke boldly about God's concerns about what's happening in the present world. They foretold, they told forth the will of God for present life. They told forth God's message for the way we live, calling human beings in both individual and collective settings to conform to the divine standards of righteousness. Brian Hare, in his very fine lecture here last year, talked about the prophetic tradition as really the teaching ministry of the church. In the broadest and, I think, most important sense of prophecy, the church is called to teach the church, teach the people of God, what God wants by way of our involvement in public life, and what God wants by way of the patterns of righteousness in the larger human community that we are called to work for. This teaching dimension is very important, and that's a broader thing than simply the foretelling dimension of prophecy that we find, say, in the being expressed these days in the best-selling Left Behind novels and in the Hal Lindsey's late great Planet Earth type, the genre of evangelical literature. Both of those tasks, foretelling and forthtelling, are assigned to the church, and we can foretell some features about what the end of history will be like, but we must also set forth our understanding of God's will for present-day life. During the As we approach the millennium, I got a lot of calls from reporters about, you know, all of the predictions about dire consequences that would occur when the year 2000 came. And I kept quoting Acts 1:11 to them, that Jesus, when he went to heaven, when he ascended, the angels came and they talked to the disciples. And they said, this Jesus who has been taken up to you into heaven will come again in the same way as you saw him go in heaven, Acts 1:11. But this word about the future came only after a very important conversation between the disciples and the Lord just before he departed from their midst. When they asked him whether he would now restore the kingdom, Jesus replied by warning them that it is not for you to know the times or periods that the Father has set by his own authority, but this they could know, he quickly added. You will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses. And the important thing then is not that we worry about the end of the earth, but that we worry about the ends of the earth, that we worry about being God's witnesses in the global community, claiming the power of the Holy Spirit to tell forth and to demonstrate in word and deed what God calls people to do by way of faithful obedience to the will of God. So that discerning of the will of God for present life and teaching both within the Christian community and in the broader human community about what God wills for this present context in public life, I think is a very important part of it, and that's a part that evangelicals need to pay more attention to when they hear the word prophecy. Another obstacle is a perspective on public life that has been shaped by many decades of the experience of cultural marginalization. I've already referred to that. Very interesting that back in the 1980s, Archbishop Rembert Weakland in the America, the Jesuit magazine, wrote a fascinating article in which he talked about the role of Roman Catholics in public life. And he said, one of the problems that we face right now in Catholicism and its relationship to public life is that the American church has been shaped by a theology that was designed to equip an immigrant community to survive on the margins of public life. It was a theology for immigrant Catholics. Boston is a good example of that, a theology for, say, Irish and Italian immigrants who came here. And it was a theology that gave them resources for surviving on the margins of public life. The big problem, Archbishop Weakland said, for today is that the sons and daughters of these immigrants are in the State Department, and they're heading up major corporations, but they're operating in positions of public leadership with a theology of cultural marginalization. And so there's a disconnect between the actual power that they have in their cultural location and the theology that has shaped their understanding of what it means to be a good Catholic in public life. I'm convinced exactly the same thing holds for evangelicals today. We have seen a tremendous upward mobility in terms of the social status of evangelicalism. 25 years ago, we were driving out, driving west, and our next-door neighbor, George Marsden, was editing an Erdmann's Encyclopedia of American Religion or something like that. And he asked my wife to take photos along the way of just ordinary churches in ordinary towns. So we'd be going through Nebraska, and we'd pull off Highway 80, and we'd go to some little town, and we'd take pictures of four or five of the churches in town. And the pattern, right across from Michigan to California, the pattern was a rather consistent one. And that is, in the center of the town, there was a big Presbyterian or Methodist church, certainly a Roman Catholic church in a lot of places, an Episcopal church, sometimes an American Baptist Convention church. And then on the edges of town, or on the wrong side of the tracks, there was a Pentecostal church, and maybe a church that said, you know, Holdridge Bible Church, we preach Christ crucified, risen, and coming again. These are the Church of the Nazarene. These were the churches that were on the edges of town, and it was a symbol of their marginalization. Those churches today own the best real estate in town. They are the mega churches. They're flourishing churches. And yet the theology that has shaped those churches is a theology of cultural marginalization, but the people who populate those churches are people who are in significant positions of cultural influence. And there has to be some way in which we rethink some of the issues. And the moral majority was an acknowledgement of that. But the problem was, it was an acknowledgement without much theological savvy. And some of the leaders of the moral majority have recognized that and have washed their hands of a lot of the things that the moral majority did. And it's a special challenge for evangelicals is that we tend to fluctuate between two moods, cultural pessimism and cultural imperialism. Put it briefly, or put it cryptically, evangelicals either separate from the culture or they want to take it over. And there's no alternative to that. And so either it's, this world is not my home and I can't feel at home in this world anymore, or it's, shine, Jesus, shine, fill this land with the Father's glory. But that middle area of knowing that we're called to do some important stuff, but that we're never going to own the territory until the Lord returns, that we're in an interim period of what the Mennonites like to call the time of God's patience, and how we are to act in that interim period where we can neither separate ourselves from the culture nor take it over, but to do something between those two options of cultural pessimism and cultural imperialism. My own view is that evangelicals actually have two theologies that are in their the collective subconscious. The first theology is the theology of Puritan theocracy. It's a theology that sees America, for example, as a chosen nation. Oh, beautiful for patriot dream that sees beyond the years, thine alabaster cities gleam undimmed by human tears. America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. That eschatological verse of America the Beautiful, which is really using imagery from the book of Revelation, that the book of Revelation applies to the holy city, the new Jerusalem, which will come down out of heaven, and saying, America is the place of that kind of promise. And so we have this sense that God has destined America to be a light unto the nations, and that we Christians need to be sure to call it back to its true Christian roots. That kind of, for those of you who know the in jargon, kind of post-millennial optimism about America as chosen nation with a manifest destiny, that's there. But when evangelicals experienced the defeats, first of all in the Darwinian crisis in the 19th century, and then through the Scopes trial and various defeats in their struggles to control the northern denominations, Presbyterianism and the like, when they experienced those defeats, they trucked out another theology of eschatological apocalyptic views that America is Babylon, things are getting worse and worse, it's a sinking ship. To try to do anything good is like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic and all that kind of thing. And so you have these two theologies. And when we're feeling like we are on the margins of things, we think one theology. But as soon as it looks like we may be able to have a handle on things and gain a little bit of power, the other one sort of emerges. And we're never quite aware of what's going on. We really haven't thought it through. And I think the moral majority was an outbreak of that cultural imperialism based on a kind of post-millennial optimism about America. And the danger is then that we move to left behind and apocalypticism again. And we need to explore an alternative to both of those moods. And so I want to turn now for the rest of my talk to exploring some of the positive things. What would help all of this spiritually and theologically? And I have a couple of points. And the first is this. Evangelicals need to develop a theology of the common good. I saw my friend David Hollenbeck, Father David Hollenbeck, who can't be here this evening, but he was nice enough to stop by and say hello. His book on Christian ethics and the common good is a wonderful book. And it's the kind of book that evangelicals need to read and to struggle with and think about ways in which we might develop a very similar theological, philosophical understanding of the common good. I've been preaching this quite a bit, and Roman Catholicism has much to teach us here. John Courtney Murray's wonderful explorations of a Roman Catholic theology of the American experience, of what it means to be in an American-type democracy in a pluralistic setting, is a wonderful resource for us to utilize and use as a reference point for our own discussions. When the Roman Catholic Church acknowledged openly that error has rights, that's in many ways a profound acknowledgement both for Roman Catholics and for evangelicals. There was back in post-Reformation Scotland, one of the Calvinist martyrs put to death by Catholics, James Durham, just before he was executed for his active opposition to any political concessions on the part of Presbyterians to either Anglicans or Roman Catholics, he proclaimed, this is allegedly his, just before he was hanged, he said this, "Toleration doth either account little of error as being no hurtful thing, and so there can be no esteem of truth, or it doth account little of the destruction of souls." You know, either you don't take truth seriously or you don't worry enough about souls. And he says, both of which must be abominable. You know, we can't compromise on anything. And in fact, that viewpoint corresponds closely to an assessment given a few years ago by the well-known Israeli philosopher Rabbi David Hartman, in which he says that when a reporter asked him about Jewish resources for understanding conflict in the Middle East, he says the biblical framework, I'm quoting him here, this is you can find this in David Shipler's fascinating book called Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in the Promised Land. Rabbi David Hartman said, "The biblical framework is not the source of tolerance. That's not the place you go for that. You go there for passion, for zealousness, for extremes. Biblical people are extremists." And Roman Catholicism has had to struggle with that. thinking theologically about an alternative to intolerant, extreme anti-pluralism. And evangelicals need to do a lot of work on that as well. I wrote a book a couple years ago on civility, and I was actually inspired by a wonderful comment that Martin Marty makes in one of his works, where he says that in American society today, civil people often don't have very strong convictions, and people with strong convictions aren't very civil, and what we need is convicted civility. And I thought, now there's an important challenge. How do we work for a pluralistic society, for the common good, without sacrificing our convictions? And I think there are important theological resources to explore there. Catholicism has a number of options open to it. You get Mother Teresa's sort of Franciscan view that what you see when you look at the other person is Jesus. She wants her, she tells a story in one of her, she's quoted in a book about her, where a nun, young woman comes to join her order in Calcutta and immediately wants to go out and serve the lepers. And Mother Teresa says, no, for the first 6 months, you need to contemplate the Blessed Sacrament and study the Gospels so that through this contemplation, she said, we're a contemplative order, we're not an activist order. Through this contemplation, you get to know Jesus so intimately that you can then go out on the streets and recognize him in his dreadful disguise. In that sense of the presence of Christ in the other, even in the non-Christian other. It's been a powerful theme in roughly Franciscan-type Catholic spirituality, which is where I would link Mother Teresa and, to some degree, the Catholic worker movement. Brian Hare, Father Hare last year, talked more about, has a more general view of a kind of incarnationist approach. In my own evangelical Calvinist tradition, I think a powerful resource is simply creation. The fact that every human being is created in the Imago Dei, in the image of God, and that we acknowledge the divine image in the other person. So I think we need to explore theological resources for developing a working account of the common good. And biblically, there's a lot we can draw on there. I've been going back and forth to China a couple times this year, and it's very interesting that, I'll say this parenthetically, the Three Self Church in China, the registered Protestant churches in China, are very fundamentalistic. They bear all the marks of the kind of fundamentalism that Carl Henry was describing in his 1947 book, The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism, except for the additional fact that even if they had been very publicly minded, they would